Hello, I'm Stephen Rumford, and this is the Life and Death Podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice Care, a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, and so much more. I've worked in palliative care for over 20 years, and in this series I talk to people who've experiences of death and dying, to try and get a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. Today's guest is Sam Genders, critically acclaimed songwriter and frontman of English folktronica band Tongue. Now, I've been a fan of Sam's band for a long time, so I was particularly excited to talk to him. Sam, good to meet you. Really terrific to meet you.
It's lovely to meet you, sort of, almost in person.
Since forming in 2003, Tongue have released 7 studio albums and have continued to push genre boundaries. She can see her lungs resting on the ceiling. She can see her heart. Their most recent release is a project entitled Tongue Presents Dead Club, which saw the band conducting interviews with those working in the field of death. The result was the release of their podcast series entitled Tongue Presents the Dead Club Podcast, as well as a full-length album inspired by their research, featuring such songs as Eating the Dead and Death is the New Sex. When the 42 comes, she boards a white bus. Sam and I covered a lot of ground, discussing his views on life, death, and yes, even sex. But we start by talking about Sam's early life and the origins of Tongue.
Yeah, well, I was born in Cheltenham, actually, but after about a year moved up to Derbyshire and kind of got interested in music along the way. In my early 20s, I moved to London with the hope, really, of doing something a bit more with music. And after a year or two, I met a producer called Mike Lindsay. So he and I formed a band called Tongue, T-U-N-N-G. We were very lucky. The music was kind of sort of blended electronics with folk-inspired songwriting, and just about the time that the album came out, this sort of whole scene exploded that, you know, was exploring those elements. So we were incredibly lucky, and it meant that we got invited to play a lot of things, including some radio sessions, and our attempts to recreate the music between the two of us had been fairly shambolic. So we needed to get some help, and Phil Winter, Ashley Bates, Becky Jacobs and Martin Smith stepped in to help us do the sessions. But, you know, it really clicked. We went on to play a lot of shows and had some adventures.
I was trying to remember this afternoon when I was just jotting a few things down, when I first became aware of Dead Club in terms of a piece of work that you guys had done. And I mean, this sounds very kind of fannish, and I'm sorry, but I was really excited about it coming out. And, you know, it was a big deal for me, your podcast. I was super excited, and it really, really didn't disappoint. It was a great piece of work.
Thank you.
And it meant a lot to me, actually. For anyone that doesn't know about the Dead Club project, can you explain what it is?
So Dead Club is a project whereby we, as a band, Tongue, we spent about a year actually researching our culture's relationship to death and dying. So we read books, we interviewed people who, you know, either work closely with death or have written about death. And then we used those interviews and that research as the basis for writing the music for an album. And we made that album. In the process of doing this, we actually, the conversations we had as part of the research were so interesting that we actually turned them into a podcast series as well.
Yeah, it is a wonderful project. So Good Arrows, I think, was your third album, but it was the first one that I'd ever heard of Tongue's. So as I was preparing for this, having listened to the podcast, etc., and preparing to do this interview with you, I went back and listened to that album. And you have a tune on there called Hands. You have these wonderful lines. You talk about either things or people pressing onto you and into you, atoms pressing into you, lips pressing into you, words pressing into you. Leave your imprint upon every mouth that you press against. And then I can't remember the line exactly, but you sort of say, you know, and at the end we're all going to die. It's okay, because one day we will be dead. And I suppose I wondered, was that an early expression or an early exploration of that topic as something for you as an artist?
It is. Death is one of the themes of that song, and the song is sort of initially about a surgeon who's tried to save someone's life in A&E, and he's failed to do so. And it's about the fragility of life and the preciousness of life, I guess. It's one of maybe two songs on that record and two or three songs on other records that touch on the subject of death. What I find fascinating is that people think that's a little odd in general, which I think's a little odd, because, you know, death really affects us all so intimately and in very painful ways for almost everyone, really important ways for everybody. So the fact that it's so rarely mentioned, to me, that's a little unusual, I think. And it suggests to me there's a little bit of avoidance going on subconsciously or culturally, that's we don't naturally have those conversations. I find death as interesting as I find life, and I find love interesting. These are the big themes of life to me, and worthy of exploration.
I do want to talk about the process of your decision to do the album, Tongue Presents Dead Club. Did you have the sort of bare bones of songs that were thematically going to fit?
Yeah, well,
that?
Actually, what happened was I actually wrote a song. So very early on, I don't think we'd even decided. We hadn't quite agreed that we were going to do this. And I wrote a song about my gran, actually, who my granny died of an aortic aneurysm very suddenly. So I'm not sure when, 20 years ago, maybe. While she was eating a ham sandwich. And so I wrote this song called Ham Sandwich Requiem, which was kind of for my granny. It was a song that we thought was quite a good song, and we found it quite moving around the band, but it's not actually on the album because it just didn't, it was like it was from a different album. It didn't quite fit the flow of the songs. In some ways, it was the easiest album to write, certainly from my point of view, because the interviews were just so, I was really, really inspired by the subject matter and affected by it. And it was having quite a profound effect on me, you know? So the lyrics just came really quite easily, and the songs just came quite easily during that period.
And it's part of the, you know, the way storytelling works. Your image of storytelling is around the campfire or around a fireplace,
yeah.
Or maybe, you know, with a bedside lamp on. There's always a sense of a clearing of light and then just sort of darkness all around you. That's the nature of telling a story, that you're creating a little clearing. But then what happens at the end of life, in an ideal world, would be like what happens at the end of a book or a movie, that story is wound up, that it has some sort of meaningful conclusion.
Hover in the world, fatally sore. We flounder in the dark, take hold of another, go mad in a moment. The soil and the wonder sway to the terror.
In terms of the podcast, you speak to, I'm not going to ask you to pick your favourite, as it were, of the podcast in terms of, but I just wondered if you had sort of key take-homes from the podcast, from any of your contributors. I know you spoke a lot. I've heard you speak subsequently about something that Catherine talks about, Catherine Mannix, who's written a lot around death and dying, about sitting with someone with the death rattle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, first of all, you know, I think there are certain subjects that are very, very important to us as human beings, but that have also passed through a very strong cultural filter of one kind or another. So I would say sex is one of these topics because, you know, you'd be forgiven for thinking in sort of public conversation that nobody ever thinks about sex, you know, whereas of course that's not true at all. It's important to most of us on some level. And I think death's another one. And I think when you bring up these subjects, with people in a more open conversational way, it can trigger a real reaction. And so I definitely have experienced some people kind of feeling this isn't something you should be talking about. And what struck me about the Catherine Mannix, that particular story of hers, and which is that she's often had the experience of having to explain to the relative of a dying person what the death rattle is. And I know you know this, but so the death rattle, if I understand it correctly, is a kind of, it's a noise that's made in the throat, and it's a sign that the person is so deeply unconscious that they're absolutely not suffering. Whereas often the relatives, if they've not been told that, they assume that it's a sign of great physical discomfort. So it's very distressing for the relative. Now, that to me is just a really clear example of how, on a very practical level, certain conversations about end of life can really serve us all so much, because there's a good chance that many of us will find ourselves in that situation, you know, where a loved one is dying and they're making this noise, and instead of it being really distressing, there could be some comfort in knowing that the relative isn't physically suffering at that point. So, you know, that had a real impact on me.
I know that part of the inspiration behind this whole project was Max Porter's book, Grief is the Thing with Feathers. And I really like the interview you did with Max. I loved his non-sentimental directness. You know, I'm not a big fan of sentimentality myself, so it did lots of chiming in my head. You know, I work in the world of palliative care, and there's always a place for sentimentality. Okay, so I need to preface it by that. There is a place, because that, you know, and my mum, I used the example in a previous podcast with Barbara Ann, our chief exec, and sort of called it a Clinton's Cards moment. And I don't know if I said it, but my mum loved Clinton's Cards. And I used to buy like fancy arty postcards and write a nice little verse. And she'd go, thank you. And what I realised she wanted was an absolutely massive card with 5 pages of really, really cheesy verses. That's what she loved. And that's what would well her up. So sentimentality is it's a key to a certain kind of emotionality. But at times, I also think it's a limiter. It's a kind of safe space to feel things, but limits what those feelings, the depth of those feelings. So I do have a sort of, I call it a critique, that's way too fancy, but, you know, I have a sort of ambivalent relationship to sentimentality.
Yeah, well, I think that's what attracted us to Max's book, really, is that it presents grief, every facet of grief. You know, there's anger and rage and deep love and humour, and you know, I'm not an expert. I'm very much learning all the time, and I'm really quite ignorant about this, about the subject of death and grief and dying. But what I have noticed is that from the conversations I have had with people who are grieving, that it can be radically different for different people, and it can be radically different for those people from one day to the next or 1 hour to the next. And I think, you know, there's a sort of cultural idea of grief, which I think is connected to that kind of Clinton's Cards idea. And it's the sort of scene in a film of the funeral, and there's a sort of noble sadness. And that is something that people experience. But I think if that's all you ever see, just that and a sort of sentimental kind of picture of it, then I think it potentially, again, I'm not an expert really, but potentially it could be very difficult for people who are feeling rage or fear or confusion, because they might feel that there's something wrong with them, or that they can't reach out and speak to people when they really need to speak to people. And maybe you know more about this than me, but it seems that's really common, those kinds of feelings.
Yeah, I think it is. And it does flip. I mean, I know from my own, when my mum died, I was very close to my mum, and it was like being possessed. Not that I have a great deal of experience of possession, but I mean, it was like it would come through me. I mean, you know, I don't mean I was sat there sort of talking in tongues or, you know, anything like that, but it would assail me in waves. And some of those waves you'd feel the kind of early undulations of them. And some of them, it would just be like a tidal tsunami, kaboom, of whatever. Largely sadness and sort of a disbelief that they were no longer there. I couldn't, I couldn't believe that my mum was no longer there. Like, I mean, of course, one level I could, of course, could, but like on a much deeper, in a way, on a much more fully human level, I couldn't. I genuinely could not accept that she wasn't there. And I didn't have to do anything in the first 2 weeks. I didn't have to do anything to elicit those feelings. They would come unbidden at their own time and with the simplest of triggers. Like a tsunami. Tsunami. Ah, ah. I wonder, say, would you mind if I asked you? Because it's a very personal thing to talk about death, and I wonder what, I know there was an interest, but I wondered what your, you don't have to say anything or very much talk about this if you don't want to, but what's your personal experience of death and grief for you?
Thank you for asking that so considerately. So I haven't experienced the deep grief that comes, I think, with the loss of a parent or a child or a spouse. I have experienced the death of friends, and I've felt a real sadness and loss and missing them. And grandparents who I loved and enjoyed spending time with, but didn't see that often, wasn't really close to them. But I think one thing that I really noticed around this subject was my awkwardness around other people's grief and feeling not knowing what to say. Some part of me really struggled when someone was really grieving, because it's not a fixable situation, you know, and I think perhaps that's partly where my discomfort came from. But just a sort of just not knowing what to say, you know, and feeling really anxious about that. And it can seem really sort of self-centered to think, well, why on earth are you talking about how you feel when someone's grieving? But I actually think a lot of people have this experience of feeling discomfort and not knowing what to say or how to say it. And I was drawn to find out more about that, how I could be a better ally to people who are grieving. And also I think I have struggled a bit with low mood and a bit. I've struggled a lot with low mood and anxiety and things, you know, from quite a young age. And I think when you find life a bit overwhelming, sometimes that really makes you sort of get interested in the big questions. You know, why am I here? What's the meaning behind all this? It's a roller coaster. What's going on? So I've ended up reading a lot around psychology and philosophy and, spirituality, taking an interest in these things. So I'm fascinated by that, and I'm fascinated by consciousness. You know, obviously science is trying and explain it, and hasn't managed to do so just yet. You know, spirituality has explanations that I find interesting and appealing, but I haven't sort of experienced them in a way that isn't enough for me to say, okay, that's true. I'm really fascinated by consciousness and what it is and what it isn't, you know.
I can so identify with that tension between the rational and not the irrational as a negative, but the sort of non-rational at least. So Sam, on the album, there is quite a bit of humour in the songs. I'm thinking of Death is the New Sex.
Death is the new sex, everybody's talking about it. Death is the new sex, coming soon to take us home. Laser lights at me from her fingers.
I wonder whether you had any thoughts about the role of humour in talking about death or understanding death.
I don't feel like I'm an expert in humour in general, actually, but I obviously am aware that people use humour as a sort of way of getting into conversations or a way of maybe speaking about things that are difficult to speak about. But Tongue, as a band, humour has been a bit of a sort of thread through our you know, through my lyrics and through our songs. And it was natural that there would potentially be some humour in the record. And we kind of, Mike, as a producer, really wanted this to be a record that was listenable and enjoyable to listen to and didn't get too stuck in the darkness. And I think we all felt that. And I knew when I was writing the songs, I wanted it to have the full sort of spectrum of musicality about it, so it was engaging, so people would want to listen to it. Yeah, I mean, Death is the New Sex. I had been really struck by the fact, as I was having these conversations about death, that they were a bit like conversations when sex had come up in that sort of same awkwardness and the sort of same sort of feeling that perhaps people were not quite telling you what they really thought, and the feeling from some people that this is not okay to talk about. And I've felt like that when sex has come. Sometimes I've felt really sort of uncomfortable and not wanted to be honest about it or open about it. So it's not a criticism of people, but just an observation culturally. But also noticing that strangely, it seemed like we were a bit further ahead with sex. You know, sex is more often spoken about. So that was really interesting to me. And kind of as a songwriter, I'm looking for something to... a line that kind of stands out and grabs the attention and gets a meaning across in a sort of succinct way. And so that's how that chorus came about. And the rest of the song is really about palliative care and the value of palliative care.
Quietly now, turn the TV off.
Humour in palliative care would be a whole podcast, because there is a whole lot of gallows humour that goes on, you know, that you wouldn't want everyone else to listen to. But it's both a release valve. It's a way of coping with that much death. I certainly use humour. I can be horrendously inappropriate, you know, somehow skirting professionalism somehow. But that sense of humour, I do think, is vital for me as a coping mechanism, for sure. What's the sort of how's it been received? I mean, I've had my version of it, but how's it been received? What's the sort of sense of it now it is fully birthed?
I think it's been received well. You know, it's a little hard to tell. We haven't been out on tour yet, but you know, we're hoping to the end of next year. The end of this year, sorry. We've had lots of messages, like either on social media or private messages through the website, or more than we've ever had before, people saying, you know, this really touched me or helped me, and that's been really important to us, because, you know, we don't have this feeling of we know what we're talking about at all. We're sort of exploring this, and our role is the kind of ignorant seeker, trying to discover more about this topic, and we really didn't know how it was going to go down, you know. And, you know, we're not... the humour on the record, like as we've discussed, it's not there to sort of try and shock, or it's just that it's come out of the discussions and the research we've done and the themes and the ideas that have naturally come out of that. We just haven't left anything out, you know. We didn't go hallmark on it and sort of make it a sort of beautiful, you know, album full of synthesizer choirs and you know, bells and whatnot. Not that I'm knocking that.
No, that's for the part two, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's for the part two, isn't it?
I think we just really felt right from the start we wanted this to explore sort of the whole spectrum as much as possible. You know, I'm sure we've not achieved that, but we've had a go.
So, Sam, this is something I ask everyone on the podcast. Can you tell me how you feel about your own death? And I wonder if the Dead Club project has changed that view at all?
You know, the idea of being dead doesn't scare me. I'm less afraid of dying, as in the process of dying, having learnt a little bit more about palliative care. I'm very, you know, afraid of losing someone I love, and that's that's frightening, but in some ways not as frightening as it was. So for me, having these conversations and exploring this more has really been very helpful and kind of shifted my life in a fairly profound way, actually. And one thing that's very interesting has been that, going back to that issue of how it can be very difficult to speak to somebody who's grieving, through the course of the project, I had quite a few conversations with people who were experiencing deep grief, and those conversations haven't made it into podcasts for various reasons. And I found the first one of those conversations, I was so nervous. I was really, really, really nervous. And I had a conversation with a friend, and it was a really, really good conversation, and really created a bond between us. And I've had that experience again and again, this conversation around death, either with someone who's grieving or with just having a talk to someone about what their wishes might be towards the end of life, has been really powerful, and it's really created a bond between us and made us closer. So that has made me feel like a lot of that culturally we could benefit from feeling a bit more comfortable about talking about death.
Yeah, I remember when I was grieving with Mum, just to put it in, whatever anyone said to me, I was grateful for. Like, no one ever got it wrong.
Okay, yeah.
I just think it in a way, what's harder is when people don't talk about it. And I know that's slightly corny and people say it. It's particularly, I think, an issue for, I've heard it from parents who've lost children, that they no longer get spoken of, and they would much rather they were spoken of than not spoken of. You know, whatever those feelings are that are brought up are there anyway. If we don't speak of the dead, then they really have gone. There isn't even the memory and the you know, that we can bring forward with us. So it's the avoiding that causes that conflict and stress, I think, that is the issue.
You were saying, you know, just say something. It's better to say something than nothing. And that is sort of really something I've learned through the course of this project. And I think just the fact that I'm a 44-year-old man who didn't know that, I think that's a bit sad that culturally I didn't know that. I mean, I kind of sort of knew that, but not really. And I'm sure there are lots of people out there who, you know, who don't. But it also made me think. I went to a death cafe as part of the research for the album, and that was really interesting because, you know, again, I was really nervous about going. I ended up in a group of about, I think, six people, and, you know, there was a guy who was terminally ill. There was someone who had their daughter had died. Another lady was there because her sister was grieving, and she wanted to know how to support her sister. And what was interesting was just gentle little bit of facilitation. You know, a group leader kind of asked us to say why we were there. Very quickly, we were talking very openly, very honestly about very deep things, and it was really, really powerful. I left feeling kind of uplifted. You know, it was just the human. It was such a human, loving conversation, really, like with some people I'd never met before. And yeah, it was a real gateway into sort of connection. So again, that makes me feel like it's an important thing if we to try and I'm trying to learn to be better at talking about it. And you'd think after studying this for 2 years, I'd be great at talking about it, but I'm still pretty rubbish, you know, and I get nervous and I say stupid things and I kick myself and I think, what an idiot you are. How could you say that? That's so insensitive. But I think at least I'm trying and I'm making mistakes, because if you're not saying anything, then you've got no mistakes to learn from. You're not going to get any better.
Absolutely.
At it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Sam, I can't tell you what a pleasure for me personally it's been. The album's great. I think it is a really wonderful way of exploring these themes. The podcasts are well worth listening to. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Well, I've really enjoyed speaking to you. And I think, you know, this is such a, you know, what you're doing is so valuable. And you really work in palliative care, and you have such an important perspective to share. So I think thank you for doing what you're doing, and it's thank you for including us in it.
You've been listening to the Life and Death Podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice Care. Thank you to Sam Genders for chatting with me, and thank you very much for listening. You can hear Sam's most recent project, Tongue Presents Dead Club, wherever you listen to music or podcasts, and it really is worth your time. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospicecare.org.uk, for links and support. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love you to ask us any questions or share your experience of death and dying in your review, or let us know on our socials, Ashgate_hospice on Twitter and Ashgate Hospice Care on Instagram and Facebook.